This is podcast number 144 for the Well-Educated Mother's Heart. Hi, I'm Marlene Peterson, and today another story from the American Revolution. I'd like to introduce you to another author who's written a number of books to bring the American Revolution to life for young people. His name is Everett T. Tomlinson. I happened across a lecture he gave to the American Library Association in 1909 entitled The Historical Story for Boys, in which he says, "It is better to put the yeast in the bread before the bread is put into the boy." And that yeast is story. The normal boy demands a story. This is the law of life. It is more. It is as vital as breathing. So today I would like to share one of the stories of the American Revolution called How the Red Doe Changed Owners. It's taken from a book called Stories of the American Revolution by Everett T. Tomlinson, written in 1898. It is only through story that your children will sense the sacrifices made by others for them. And of course, this story is true. "I'm afraid it's the last day I'll ever see," so David Hunter said to himself as he rode on in the midst of the band of 20 men. Strange, determined-looking men were all of them, and as David glanced again at the leader, in spite of his own danger, he could but admire the strength and zeal of his captor, for David Hunter was a prisoner of David Fanning and his band of outliers. Just an hour before this time, they had swept suddenly down upon his home, having learned in some way that the zealous Whig had returned, and before he could give the alarm or make an attempt to escape, the house had been surrounded, and he had been carried away. Even now he could not shut out the sight of his weeping wife and children as they watched his departure, and the great fear in David's heart was not of what might befall him, but of what would become of those whom he had left behind. Did it pay? In spite of himself, the question forced its way into his mind. He had been laboring day and night for the good of the colonies ever since the summer of 1776, and now it was the spring of 1781. And what had been accomplished? Cornwallis had raised the royal standard at Hillsborough on February 22, 1781, and apparently the feelings of both Whigs and Tories had become more intense than ever before. The end seemed to be far away. David Hunter smiled grimly at the thought of the part he himself had taken. Early and late he had been zealous in the defense of his friends and neighbors, and up to the present day had escaped all the plottings of his enemies. Now, however, he was a prisoner of David Fanning, one of the most desperate of all the outliers in South Carolina in 1781 to 1782. He recalled many of the stories he had heard of his daring, and that he had been a carpenter until Major Craig had occupied Wilmington. Then a new field presented itself to Fanning's ambition. Clad in a long white hunting shirt, Indian leggings and cavalry boots, and mounted on a common draught horse, he had first appeared as the leader of a band of 8 or 10 marauders. He had no home, seldom entered a house, and generally passed his nights alone in some solitary place. But Major Craig appreciated his energy and fearlessness, and had secured for him an appointment as colonel in the militia. Then the white hunting shirt gave place to a gorgeous British uniform, and the sword and holster of pistols which the major also gave him were ever near him. Proud as he was of these things, however, his chief pride was in the beautiful horse he rode, the Red Doe, a gift from a royalist named Lindsay. She had become famous for her speed and intelligence before the outlier owned her, and in his desperate venture she also became one of his main reliances. Through her aid and that of his followers, he had captured Colonel Philip Alston at his own house, and not long after swept suddenly down upon Pittsburgh and carried away with him all the Continental officers stationed there. David Hunter also thought of how his own near neighbors, Charles Spearing and Captains Dreck and Dye, had been shot by this man. Fanning had gone to Spearing's home one night, and after calling for him to come forth, had shot him as he stood in the doorway. And hangings and plunderings and murders had increased until all the people in the region between the Cape Fear and Petey Rivers were living in a constant state of terror, for no one knew when his turn to suffer might come. And David Hunter's turn had indeed arrived. He thought of all these things as once more he glanced ahead at the leader. Fanning was mounted on the Red Doe, and his sword and holster of silver-mounted pistols could be seen as clearly as the brilliant-hued uniform. "There's no sympathy to be found there," thought David, as he looked away from Fanning at his other companions. "No, nor there either," he added, as he noticed the grim expressions and forbidding looks of the men. "Well, I'm sorry for Mary and the babies. I should have liked, too, to live for my country. But if I have to die, I'll do it as a man and a Christian ought. I hope those who will be born 100 years after I'm gone will appreciate the price we had to pay to give them a home and a country." Still the men rode silently forward. Not a word had been spoken since they had left David Hunter's house and had swiftly followed the Red Doe and her rider mile after mile. Whither were they going? At times a faint hope arose in Hunter's mind that they were keeping him as a prisoner and that they would deliver him up to some of the British officers. But that was not Fanning's method, as a rule, and he braced himself to meet the worst when it should come. For when he recalled the neighbors whose bodies had been left hanging from some tree by the roadside, he knew that he had little right to expect a better fate for himself. Still on and on sped the men. The Red Doe apparently was as fresh as when they started, but many of the other horses were already showing signs of distress. The pace was a swift one, and apparently the leader had no thought of resting. The horses' hoofs struck the earth together, and the appearance they presented was that of one large body moving swiftly and steadily up the road. "Perhaps I've a chance yet," thought Hunter, when at last the men halted by the roadside and a consultation took place between the leaders. Apparently no one was heeding him, but he well knew that the first suspicious movement on his part would call forth a shot. No, his only hope lay in being quiet and waiting. But no one will ever know the breathless interest with which he watched the men as they stood and talked together. Soon a band composed of half the men remounted their horses and retraced their way. David Hunter watched them until they were out of sight, and then turned just as the consultation ended. His heart sank and his lips became pale when he saw one of the men take a rope from his pack and, throwing one end over the limb of a tree, arrange a noose in the other. He knew just what those signs of preparation meant for him. If he had had any doubts, they would have been dispelled when Fanning approached him and said, "Well, Hunter, you'll have to follow the other Whigs we've sent on their way before you." "And you can't send me on to Charleston as a prisoner?" David Hunter spoke calmly. But he felt as if he never could draw breath again. It seemed to him as if his heart were held as in a vice and never would beat again. But none of his fear was betrayed in his manner or in his words. "Can't be done," replied the outlier. "I did think at first we'd keep you, for you're quite a fellow, if you are a traitor. But our plans have changed. You'll have to swing." "Think of my wife and babies," pleaded Hunter. He saw no mercy in the man before him, but in his anguish the cry broke out almost without his knowledge. "Other men had wives and babies, and they had a king, too. You should have thought of the king, and your wife and babies would have been all right. No, you'll have to swing. Come." Well knowing that further pleadings would be useless, David controlled his emotion and quietly followed the brutal leader until he stood beneath the swinging rope. Then for a moment he glanced about him. The men and horses were standing in a semicircle, but the sight of a struggling, desperate man had become so common to them all that no one displayed any special interest. At the extreme right, and only about a yard from him, stood the Red Doe, and David thought that from her eyes there shone a gleam of pity. She had been well trained, and Fanning had no need to tie her on an occasion like this. The other horses followed her as their leader, as the men did her rider, but no help, no hope could the unfortunate man see on any side of him. "Come, we'll give you 2 minutes to say your prayers in. "Be quick, for we've other business to attend to," said Fanning roughly, stepping back behind the prisoner as he spoke. And David Hunter folded his hands and knelt beneath that terrible rope hanging just over him. He had always been a God-fearing man, and every morning in his home, with his wife and children kneeling about him, had prayed to Almighty God for help through the coming day. But how different it all was now. The sight of the rope had been almost like that of a twisting, crawling serpent. And he could not shut out the vision of that rude little house that had been home to him for 5 long years. And what would become of his wife and babies now, without a protector in these terrible times, when every man's hand seemed to be against his neighbor? He could not have told just what he was asking for, but he was thinking of one who had declared that not even a sparrow fell to the ground without the notice of the great Father of all. "Fear ye not, therefore, ye are of more value than many sparrows." David opened his eyes. He did not realize how long he had been praying. It might have been for hours, as far as he knew. There stood the red doe, still looking at him with curious, pitying eyes. There stood the men just as they had been, not one having changed his position. And David still knelt, though his eyes were open now, and a new and sudden, perhaps wild, impulse was in his heart. "Finished your prayers? If you have, we'll go on with the hanging." It was Fanning who was speaking, and his voice, though rough, was not altogether unkind. "Yes, I finished my prayers," replied David Hunter, as with one quick bound he leaped to his feet and threw himself upon the back of the red doe. A quick pull at the bridle, a sharp word of command, and the beautiful beast was off up the road like a flash of light. It all happened so quickly that for a moment the band of outlaws were speechless with surprise, but it was only for a moment. David, bending low on the red doe's beautiful neck, glanced backward as he heard the shout of astonishment and anger which came a moment later. He saw the guns quickly raised to the shoulders of the men. He heard the sharp command of Fanning to aim high, and even then was dimly conscious that the leader was thinking of his fleet little steed. He closed his eyes and waited for the report. In a moment the sound of the volley rang out, and he felt a sharp pain in his left shoulder, and knew at once that the arm was useless, but also that only one bullet had hit him. Releasing his grasp on the bridle, he took a firm hold of the red doe's mane with his right hand, and leaning low on her neck, began his race for life. From behind came the shouts and calls of the angry men, but their muskets were empty now, and David knew that if the red doe could gain in the first of the pursuit, the end would take care of itself. So on and on he urged the beautiful mare, which seemed to realize that life and death were hanging on her efforts. Her hoofs seemed hardly to touch the ground. In long, steady leaps, she rushed forward, and David Hunter was clinging desperately to her neck. He could feel the red drops trickling from his left hand, and knew that by them the pursuers would have little difficulty in tracing his course. Under him he could feel the holster of silver-mounted pistols, which, next to the red doe herself, had been the pride of David Fanning's heart. Not an effort would be spared by him to regain the double prize. But the price before David Hunter was far greater than either or both, for it was life itself. On and on he urged the red doe. Soon she was flinging the foam from her lips, and her heaving sides were wet. Her nostrils were like burning coals, and above her head appeared the white and agonized face of David Hunter, who seemed to know no mercy for the beautiful beast beneath him. From time to time the shouts of his pursuers could be heard, now loud and now dim and distant, but David well knew they would follow him to the end. The minutes passed. The hot sun mercilessly poured its heat upon beast and rider, but still the red doe sped on. The click of her hoofs grew monotonous, but whenever David thought of halting, he would hear that faraway call and again would urge his noble steed forward. Suddenly she stopped and snorted with fear, and her rider lifted his head in surprise. Before him lay Little River, and the road ended on the high bluff on the bank. The waters were high, and he knew at once there was no ford. Just then he again heard the call of the outlaws, and it was nearer than before. Something must be done, but what could he do? For a moment, David hesitated, but only for a moment, for with his jaw set and an agonized expression on his face, he drew the red doe several steps back from the bank. He waited a moment, but again that terrible cry of the outliers rang out, and then, with one quick word of command, David urged her forward, and with one strong leap, she shot out over the bank and disappeared in the waters of Little River. In a moment, she rose to the surface, and after one snort of fear, arched her beautiful neck and struck out the farther shore with David still clinging to her back. In a brief time, she gained the bank, and her rider led her within the shadows of the forest and then turned to see what his pursuers would do. Soon they made their appearance, but the pursuit was ended, for not one of them dared or cared to follow the course of the fleet red doe. When David saw them turn backward in the road, he once more dropped on his knees. But this time there was no fear of the dangling noose before his eyes. It was a prayer of gratitude, and not one for release, and it was not long before David Hunter, with the beautiful red doe and no less beautiful holster of silver-mounted pistols, was safe from all pursuit. David Fanning remained in the field until the spring of 1782, when he made his way to Charleston and afterward to Digby, Nova Scotia, where he died in 1825 after having been a member of the Assembly from Queens County, New Brunswick, and serving as a colonel in the militia. Doubtless there the passions of the Revolution were forgotten, and his energy found a proper field in which to display itself. As for the red doe, there are many of her descendants today whose owners are as proud of her story as they are of her beautiful offspring. As for us, we cannot forget the question that arose in David Hunter's mind, and I'm wondering whether today we are as brave and are doing as much for our country as David and many men like him did in the time of her troubles. They labored, and we have entered into their labors. They paid the price, and we have received the value. By the way, I'll mention in that book, which I'll post in the notes of the podcast, there's a number of stories of some of the wives of the patriots and the women of the time that you might find particularly interesting. But for today, bye-bye. See you next time.